for this month is essentially, last semester we had a little bit of an exposure to Eilat Metzias. As I've mentioned, this Masechta, every parak is chock full of important Lamdisha concepts, but also very important Halacha L'maisa concepts, and different ones in each parak. So we're trying to have as much exposure as possible and as broad a way as possible to a lot of the topics of Bav Metzia. And to that extent, so we spent the Bekiah slot, our Sunday slot, the first semester learning Eilat Metzias, and we didn't get to cover all of it in Shir. I hope you made a lot of progress in the learning on your own. I hope if you have not yet, at some point you will finish the parak. Because it's our intent, again, in the interest of a broader exposure, this semester to switch over to Parak Hazav. I did notice before I was about to start this that there was at least one topic from Eilat Metzias I just wanted to follow up on, really in honor of the impending other. And not because it's a humorous topic, but because it is a topic that's relevant to Chodesh Adar. So, while I do feel that even though we didn't cover all the Gemaras last semester, but we did get a nice introduction to topics of Hashavas Aveda, topics of Yeish, of Simanim, of the basic principles that were relevant to the Perek, so I feel in that to that extent we did get a little bit of a nice overview. But one thing that I think we were about to get up to when we didn't, so I'd like to just mention it in honor of Adar, is the Gemara does have a principle regarding Yeish that Stam Yeish is Yud Beis Chodesh. That if an item has been missing for 12 months, so then we have a right to assume that the owner has given up hope, that Yeish has kicked in. So that is actually relevant to Chodesh Adar. How is it relevant? So that's a Shiloh one could raise, right? In general, there are two others, so how would that affect Hilchos Yeish? But it's actually relevant to every other. Not to every other, to every year, regardless of whether there's one or two, one other or another other. But it's relevant in general to the Hanhogis of Chodesh Adar. Because before we have Purim, so just about a month away, a little bit less than a month away. So before that, we have Parsha Zachar. And there is a major discussion about how it is that Parsha Zachar plays out the way it does. Because you'll hear in your shuls right before Parsha Zachar that this is the one time a year when Kriyas HaTorah is an obligation min HaTorah. And therefore, everyone should make sure to come to shul, even if they wouldn't otherwise come to shul. They should make sure to come for that Kriya Satorah, for the Kriya of Amalek, which we actually read yesterday, right, about the attack of Amalek. And then the mitzvah to remember of Amalek is in Parshas Kiseitze. So we have a mitzvah to remember Amalek that appears there. So because of that, the announcement usually is a mitzvah d'oraisa to hear Kriyas HaTorah on that Shabbos, the Shabbos before Purim, when we have a special Kriya devoted to that section from Parshas Kiseitze. So, not to undermine that announcement, and one should definitely be in shul for that, but it is a little bit questionable how true that statement is. First of all, to say it's the only time it's Daraisa, so there are debates that maybe there are other Krios that are Daraisa, and that maybe within the Dalet Parshios, there's at least one other that's a candidate to be a Daraisa. We'll talk about that later. But the assumption that there's a Chi of Daraisa on that Kriya, to hear Zachar, that Shabbos, is something that requires a little bit of explanation. So it's all based on the pasuk that we read then, the pasuk in Parshas Kiseitze, which says, "Zachar es asher asalacha Amalek," we should remember that which we read about yesterday in Parshas Bishalach. But how do we know that any of the announcement details are true? Or how do we know that that means we have to remember it through Kriyas HaTorah, through Kriyas HaTorah with the minyan? And how do we know that it has to happen when we do it? So all of those are subject to discussion. The assumption that it requires the Kriyas HaTorah. Some of the Achronim have attached that to the Pasuk, So Zos Zikaron B'Sefer. The idea that it requires a minyan is interesting. It's not so obvious. It's basically based on a Russian Maseches Brachos, which is subject to debate, whether or not that's what he means. And Trumas Hadashim, in his Chuvas, the Trumas Hadashim writes that somebody asked him, or he discusses the hypothetical, that somebody wrote, they live in a town where there's no minyan. So they plan on going to a town with a minyan for Purim, so they can hear the Megillah. So the question was, should they make sure to come early, to come for Shabbos before Purim, so that they'll also hear Parshas Zachar? And the response was, not only is that a good idea, not only should you come early to come for Shabbos, but it's more important to be there for Shabbos than for Purim, because Megillah Bismano doesn't require a minyan. You can read Megillah without a minyan. It happens all the time. People are in nursing homes, people are sick at home. Somebody goes to read the Megillah for them. We don't require that there be a minyan present when it's done on Purim. But Parsha Zachar says the Trumas Hadashim, maybe says the Rush, that requires a minyan, you should be there for that. So that was debatable. There's a whole discussion about whether or not that's the only way to see things. But because of the influence of that reading of the Rush and the Trumas Hadashim, so it's assumed that you need a minyan, assuming you need a Sefer Torah. Later posts can discuss a suggestion, maybe it doesn't need to be a kosher Sefer Torah, others reject that discussion. So all the details are a subject to debate in terms of the tzura of the fulfillment of the mitzvah of Zechiras HaMalek. Okay, but let's say we establish that, based on whatever cheshbon we use, that you need a minyan and you need a Kriyas HaTorah in order to fulfill the words of the Pasuk, Zachar Sashar HaSalach HaMalek. Again, that everyone agrees. The Rambam seems to write Beferish through all the Dalet Parshiyos of the Rabbanan, the way the Ramban seems to understand. But let's assume, let's take it for given, that that's what the mitzvah of Zechiras HaMalek involves, min haTorah. But still, the very pressing question is, so how often do we really have to do it? How do we know that it has to be once a year? How do we know when it should be? So in general, if it's not clear in the Torah how often it has to take place, how do we decide? We know that when it comes to tefillah, so the Rambam's opinion, and we alluded to a little bit on Thursday, the Rambam's opinion is that tefillah is a mitzvah saseh min haTorah, that we have a Torah obligation to daven once a day. So the Kiryas Sefer and others discuss, so even though the Rambam actually has a pretty good mucker for the idea of tefillah min haTorah, as the Gemara at the beginning of Tainus does seem to darshan a pasuk that way, so it's probably a little bit stronger than the views of the other Rishonim, but it's not clear that it's a daily obligation. How do you know that that's a mitzvah every day? So the Kiryas Sefer writes over there that if the Torah gives you an obligation and doesn't specify how often it is, so presumably it's got to either be once in a lifetime or once a day. So it doesn't make sense to say it's a mitzvah once in a lifetime to daven. So presumably it's a mitzvah every day. So what do we do with Zachar HaMalek? How do we get to the conclusion that it has to be once a year? Where did that come from? Now there are those who recite the Zechiras every day. That's not done with the Kriyas HaTorah and a minyan, but in the Sidurim they print the six Zechiras, and there are those who recite them every day. It's not an interesting discussion, which is worth getting into more detail at a different time. The whole concept of the mitzvah of Zechira, that we say there are six Zechiras today, so it's not also so obvious that that's the case. But if you count up the times in the Torah that there is a mitzvah of Zechira specific towards one concept, so you get different ways of counting. We commonly say there are six Zechiros, but not everyone counted that way. In some of the Svarim, they counted four. It's a question, what makes the cut? What Lashonos do you take seriously as an obligation of Zechira? And some count more. And the Sefer Kedushas Levi, the Torah of Levi Yitzchak of Berdicha, the Halak Tzaddik. So the Kedushas Levi has on the cover that he also has a kuntres, not just on the Chumash, but he also writes on the Sheish Zechiros. But his six are different than our six. So if you take all the possibilities, he talks there about the Zechiras Haman, not Haman, but the Man that we read about again in these past Parshias, and Zechiras Eretz Yisrael. So you could get somewhere between 4 and 11 mitzvahs of Zechira, depending on how you count. So nowadays, in Ashkenazi tradition, we tend to assume that there are six mitzvot of zechira, and it's a fascinating discussion one could have. Why those six, if you agree on those six, and also why it is that even if we acknowledge that all six of these are obligations min haTorah to perform a mitzvah of zechira, they come out in totally different ways. It's kemat true that no two zechiros are performed the same way. So, for example, one of the indisputable mitzvahs of zechira we'll read about in this coming week's parsha. We'll read about Zachar Shema Shabbos Lakacho, which we interpret in a number of ways, but primarily as the mitzvah of Kiddush. But even that's subject to a lot of discussion, and there are no fewer than 15 different opinions as to what the mitzvah of Kiddush min haTorah is as a fulfillment of Zachar Shema Shabbos Lakacho. So it means Kiddush, which is a broad range of possibilities, and we know also the topic of these past few weeks, Parshias, we have an obligation of Zechiras Yetzias Mitzrayim, which we fulfill every day, but on Pesach in a different way. So we have all the Zechiras manifest themselves in different ways, which itself is interesting. But in any event, when it comes to Zachar Asher Asalach HaMalek, so how exactly we perform it, and when we perform it, everything is subject to discussion. So in the context of a malek, the Torah says not only to remember it, but also lo sishkach, you shouldn't forget. So what's the chiddush of telling you remember and don't forget? So the Gemara says in Maseches Megillah that's to tell you that it has to be verbal. That you could have thought, yachol belev, you maybe would have thought, that if I just remember Amalek, I think about it, I don't say it out loud, that would be enough. But apparently not, you have to actually say it out loud. So what that means is still an interesting discussion. The Ravid in his commentary to the Torah's Kohanim understood that it actually means to learn the halachas of remembering Amalek, to learn Maseches Megillah. There's again a lot of many different opinions as to how this mitzvah is fulfilled. But there is a tradition from the Chassam Sofer, which is not, if I'm correct, not explicit in the Chassam Sofer's Tshuvas. In fact, there may be things in the Chassam Sofer's Tshuvas that contradict some of what we're about to say. But mostly through one of his very notable Talmidim, the Maram Shik, was a great posek who was a student of the Chassam Sofer. So we have through him a tradition in the name of the Chassam Sofer, that the idea that we read Parsha Zachar once a year is based on that lo sishkach. So the Torah says you have to remember, that's a positive concept, and you can't forget. So what does it mean not to forget? So the tradition that's attributed to the Chassam Sofer is that there is a shir shikha, that there is a period of time after which people begin to forget things. How long is that period? That period is 12 months. How do you know? So it's based on two Gemaras, one of which we just mentioned, that in the second parak above Metziah, so the Gemara tells us that Stam Yeish is 12 months. So apparently after 12 months, people begin to forget about things. The other Gemara is Gemara Maseches Brachos. It says regarding Avelus, Ein Hameis Mishtakeach Min Alev Ela Acher Yud Beis Chodesh. People only begin to forget about someone who's passed away after 12 months. So based on these two Gemaras, so we have this idea that there is a concept of a Shir Shekha, that after 12 months, something begins to fade from memory, and therefore if the Torah says, Lo Sishkach, you're not allowed to forget, so apparently we have to be reminded every 12 months. So this provoked a whole other issue, which the Maram Shik discusses. And a little bit, it was alluded to in what Aaron said before. So that creates a complication that if we had a leap year, so a leap year places an extra Adar right before we fulfill the mitzvah of Zechir Samalik, since our practice is that when there are two Adars, be a problem anyway, but the way we do it is that when there are two Adars, so we have Purim and all its related observances take place in the Adar that is closest to Nisan and Adar Beis. So then it's going to happen when you have a leap year that 13 months will pass between the previous reading of Amalek and the second reading of Amalek. So should we then be afraid that we're going to be mevatel this mitzvah saseh min haTorah of Zechiras Amalek? So there were those who were concerned about that, and there were those who suggested that in a leap year, one should have kavana during the summertime when they read Parshas Kiseitzeh, to have intent to fulfill the mitzvah of Zechiras HaMalek then, because otherwise too long of a tekufa will pass before you get to the Amalek in Shul, and the whole discussion, does the Baal Kori have to know about this? Does he have to have kavana? Or is he based on Frank? Is it true about that? You could argue a lot of the pratim about that, but that's a whole halachic discussion that emerges from that question. And others feel that that wouldn't necessarily be a problem. The expression 12 months that we use here doesn't necessarily have to mean 12 months. I remember, I think it was my first year here in Yeshiva, they were learning about Metziah that year. And Rabbi Willig was in Avelis for his mother. And in June's month, so they had Shiurim on maybe the second park above Metziah. So Rabbi Willig gave a shiur, was his mother's yahrzeit then. So the end of the first year was the first yahrzeit. So he discussed this question, if I remember correctly. And he noted the possibility that it doesn't really mean 12 months in the literal sense, but that it means the cycle of a year, that once he hit the next point in the cycle, so something that happened in Hanukkah, so by the time the next Hanukkah comes around, so then the memory kind of resets. It needs to be reminded, otherwise it kind of clears out, purges everything from before that. So it's based on the cycle of the year. It's not based on it being exactly 12 months. And if the cycle happens to be 13 months, it'll also be 13 months. So whether or not one has to worry about this 12 months being literal, that's subject to discussion. But then there are others who dismiss the whole concern anyway, because one could question this whole concept of a Shir Shikha. The Satmar Rav has a tshuva about this in his Divriyot, that he didn't accept this whole idea of a Shir Shikha. And as he noted, one could question both of the proofs, the idea that you have a 12-month limit before you start to forget things. So both proofs are somewhat questionable. So for example, the Gemara about Ein HaMeis Mishtakech Min Alev, El Alachi Yid Beis Chodesh, you forget about somebody who passed away after 12 months. That means that you have someone who's trying to get past a loss, somebody who's trying to overcome their grief. After 12 months, it starts to work. Doesn't mean that if there was a mitzvah to remember something, that they wouldn't be able to keep that memory alive more than 12 months. It means that when there's an effort to forget, it starts to work at that point. Secondly, the Gemara in our Masechta about the Yeish, so it's important to remember that Yeish doesn't mean forgetting. Yeish is not the same thing as forgetting. Yeish means you give up hope that it's going to return. So the person who's Miyayish after 12 months, perhaps he has a little shrine on his wall to his lost object that he remembers constantly, and it's always on his mind, but he just has given up hope that it's ever going to come back at that point. So there isn't necessarily any connection between the concept of Yeish or the concept of forgetting. So for that reason, and the other reason, so the Satmar Rav disputed this whole idea, and he understood simply, as the Magen Avraham notes, that the fact that we have this observance of Zechiras HaMalek every year when we do, it's because of the thematic connection between Purim and Amalek, and our belief that Haman is the continuation, the descendant of Amalek and his war on the Jewish people, and therefore we assume that it's appropriate to juxtapose the two. So we have Parshas Zachar in a yearly cycle immediately before Purim because of that connection. So there's a lot of discussion about that. In any event, none of this is meant to undermine the, at the very least, Minhag Yisrael, so we make sure to be in shul for Parshas Zachar, the Shabbos before Purim, which this year will be the day before Purim, if I'm not mistaken. But it's a question whether or not it's a concept that emerges out of the Gemara in the second parak of Bava Metziah. So with that, now let's turn our attention to the fourth parak of Bava Metziah. So as I'm sure you've noticed, the fourth parak of Bava Metziah, at least at the beginning, is a little bit of a challenging Gemara. And it's meant to be that way. You shouldn't feel like you're alone if that's how it came across. But it's very kedai. I don't know how many yeshivas learn the fourth parak of Bava Metziah in a formal setting. Even the second and third parakim are sometimes learned in elementary school. So you sometimes get an exposure to those parakim, at least at that age. And as we see, the first parak of Bava Metziah, later parakim and parakim of Bava Metziah are sometimes at least on the curriculum of the yeshiva. But the fourth parak is not so often learned officially, and it's very important. It has a lot of halachic relevance, and it has a lot of lomdusha relevance to other concepts. So what we'll try to do, maybe we'll start to read the Gemara together also, but in any event, let's try to at least mention some of the concepts that come up in this parak. So the major theme, and the major theme that's very relevant to Lahalacha Lamaisa, is the concept of onah, that there is a prohibition of price fraud, so to speak. There is a prohibition to fool someone in terms of how much something costs, whether you are the seller or the buyer, so you're fooling them in either direction. And there are all kinds of rules that regulate how that happens. Hi.
Does it have to be fooling?
I mean, does it have to be intentional?
Taking advantage of someone, let's say.
So that we're taking advantage would probably be the same thing as fooling. The question of whether you're saying something to fool them or whether you're passively letting them be fooled.
It's their only option.
Oh, so they're right.
Any other options. Oh,
I mean, they know that it's right. So then that we'll discuss. Then there are all kinds of details of what this applies to and what it doesn't apply to, and especially when it's their only option. So we'll have to get into it. Sorry? No, the Sachmud has some overlap with this concept, but it's probably a different idea. That Sachmud is they don't want to sell it at all, and they just can't stand your chepering them. But here, they have to sell it for whatever reason. Maybe they need the money, or they need to buy the item that you're selling.
Maybe they want the money themselves also.
That could be. Well, they need the money, maybe. You know, as we discussed, the wanting money is probably not a violation of Lo Sachmud. It's interesting, you know, just two current events. It's about Lo Sachmud, you bring it up, and its relationship to money. So it was a great loss to Klal Yisrael, and especially to those learning above Metzia in the past week or so. Rav Yaakov Yishaya Bloy passed away. He was the author of the Pesachei Choshed, one of the modern classics of Dinei Mamonos, and he also wrote a separate volume on Ribbis, so that's the topic of the fifth parak of Bav Metzia. Those who learn this Masechta Lamaisa have a tremendous debt to Rav Yaakov Yishaya Bloy, so that happened the past few weeks. Also what happened in the past few weeks is Yibad Al-Chayim Rav Asher Weishlita came out with a Sefer Shalos and Tshuvas, which I have not yet seen in America. I was able to get a copy when I was in Eretz Yisrael. Okay, so I didn't see that, but so I have a copy that I obtained in Eretz Yisrael. So there was, I noticed since then, since we learned the Sugya of Lo Sachmud last semester, I only saw this afterwards, that there is a machlokas between Rav Asher Weiss and Rav Bloy the Pesachei Choshen concerning one of the aspects of Lo Sachmud related to this point, that there was a long-standing practice, I don't know how often this happens nowadays, that Mechabrim who writes Svarim, so they'll mail them to people who may or may not have heard of them, and they'll then expect to be paid. You should, I sent you my Sefer, now you have to pay me for the Sefer. So that practice, so Rav Bloy writes in his Sefer, in his Pesachei Choshed, that's a violation of Lo Sachmud. You're essentially pressuring the person to pay for the Sefer, and therefore that extraction of money that way is Lo Sachmud. And Rav Asher Weiss in his Tshuvas, he has a Tshuva arguing on this point, where he says, it's not Lo Sachmud, you'll recall, but when we discussed the Sugya, so we mentioned that it seems to be that Lo Sachmud really addresses itself to a specific item and not to the value of the item. And also emerges from your desire to have the other person's thing, not from some general desire to have more stuff that you would have regardless of that person. So with both of those, he sold those in mind. So he assumes that there is no Lo Sachmud regarding money, and therefore the fact this person is pressuring you to pay for the Sefer that he sent you without your asking for it is not a violation of Lo Sachmud. Doesn't mean you have to pay for it, but it's not considered to be a violation of Lo Sachmud. That's how he assumes it. Just to bring up the topic, it's a little Hosafa that draws on these two current events. So in any event, so this parak deals with Onah, and I would like to give you a general hakdama to the concepts of Onah and to address the question that Menachem is asking me and everything else that will come up. But the truth is, Onah is going to come up a little bit later in the parak. It basically starts around Daf Nun. So maybe we'll delay that particular hakdama, and we will take the opportunity to get into those details. Just to be aware of, there's Onah in the monetary sense, and there is also a prohibition of Onah's Devarim. There is emotional onah, and that's also dealt with in this parak. Hopefully we'll have the opportunity to speak about both of them. Hi.
Also, is the concept of onah in like a sixth, is that still, is that halach l'maisa?
Yeah.
That's the measure?
Yeah, we'll have to talk about how it gets measured. Again, that, all those are details in terms of onah. What the Menachem is referring to is that there is this measure of how off the price is. You say that you can't deal with a price that's out of whack with what it should be, whether it's in favor of the seller or in favor of the buyer in either direction. So we have a range of a sixth where more than a sixth the sale gets negated. At a sixth, the sale doesn't get negated, but there's still an isser. Less than a sixth, there is mechila. We'll talk about all these details. So for now, let's assume that they do apply. We don't necessarily have a reason to say that they shouldn't apply. There are all kinds of variables in the modern market that we'll try to address a little bit. This is separate from the question of profit. The Gemara in Maseches Bava Basra talks separately about the question of how much profit it's appropriate to mark something up, what's considered to be reasonable, and is there a difference between crucial necessities and luxury items and the like. So we'll talk about that just by reference, but that's different than the concept of onah. Onah has to do with what the price should be after profit is already accounted for. So then what is the market rate for something, and for somebody to be out of whack of that market rate is to a significant degree is something that's both usur and subject to a penalty. So those are two separate dinim that don't always go together. You can have the penalty without the isser. I thought that was what you were asking before when you said, does it have to be that he fooled him? It could be it was a mistake. And it could be that the two parties just didn't realize, but then there still may be the consequence. So you could theoretically have the penalty without the isser, and you could have the isser without the penalty. There will be circumstances where the penalty doesn't kick in, but it's still wrong. So we'll have to talk about all those things. Again, we'll get into a full Hakdama of Onah when we're closer to the Gemaras that talk about it. But the first part of the parak, before getting into that, talks about something else, which Darshan's a pasuk that is shared with Onah, so that's part of why the parak talks about it. But it's very important concepts for related and other areas of halacha. So the title of the parak is Hazav, and it gets its name from the discussion of the interaction between Zav and Kesef and other materials as they relate to each other. That the Mishnah essentially talks about if somebody is trading Zav for Kesef, gold for silver, so we want to define what is the commodity and what is the currency. And why does that make a difference? It makes a difference for a bunch of things. In general, there is a concept of currency in halacha, and sometimes we require specifically currency. In general, we have a rule, shav kesef kekesef, so if somebody wants to get married, so he has kinyan kesef. The kinyan kesef doesn't mean necessarily he has to give cash. It means that anything that's worth cash, and indeed that's our practice, as the Kesef Mishnah notes, that we want to highlight the concept of the Torah Shabbat Peh, which teaches us that Shavu Kesef is Kekesef, and therefore our practice has developed that we davka do Kedushin through Kesef and through Shavu Kesef in the form of a ring. But there are mitzvos that require specifically currency. So in general, it's important for us to define what's called currency and what may be worth money, and other contexts be subject to the rule of Shavu Kesef Kekesef, but are called commodities. So why do we care in some other contexts? For example, the Gemara is going to talk about Pidgin Meiser Sheni. That's going to come up a little bit, about the idea that when you have items that are essentially Kodesh, that are Meiser Sheni and meant to be brought to Yerushalayim, so sometimes if it's too difficult to carry them down, so they can be redeemed onto money. So we have to know a little bit what's called money and what's called commodity. The Gemara is going to get into that a little bit on Amid Beis of this Gemara. I don't know if any of you got up to that on Mandalat Amid Beis. The Gemara will already get into that a little bit. But before that, the Mishnah talks about it for one reason in the Mishnah, and there's another reason that's going to come up very often, and that's brought up in the Gemara and the Dalar Mabes. It's a ribis concept. So ribis is a topic of Parak Ezu Neshach. Again, we'll have some opportunity this semester to be exposed to Hilchos Ribbis as well. But in Hilchos Ribbis, it's especially important to define commodity and currency because of an Issa D'Rabbanan that's called Sa B'Sa. That we have an Issa D'Rabbanan that it's a problem. There are many, many exceptions to this Issa D'Rabbanan, some of which are alluded to in this daf. So it's a problem that has many easy remedies to it, but theoretically, there's a problem called Sa B'Sa, that if I lend you a commodity, and I expect you to return the commodity to me, so that invokes ribbis problems and Issa D'Rabbanan, because we're worried that the commodity is going to go up in value. So if I lend you sugar, and you return to me an equal amount of sugar, so you might say, okay, it's not interest, you lent me X amount of sugar, and I gave you back X amount of sugar. The problem is that X amount of sugar could go up in value in that time. So now what you will be returning to me might be essentially shavu kesef kekesef, be worth more money than what I lent you, and may incur problems of ribbis. So therefore, there is a theoretical issue with commodity loans. They say theoretical against an actual issue, but there are many, many ways to deal with it, which are relatively simple, so we'll call it for now a theoretical issue. But there is on the books an issue of loaning commodities in such a way. Now, that could be, you could have theoretically the same issue when it comes to currency. So then I can't lend money at all, because if I'm going to lend you $10, and you're going to pay me back $10, so there's no ribbis, you're paying back the same thing that you borrowed. So the problem is that we know that those of us who follow the currency markets, we know that money changes value all the time. The dollar's value rises and falls every day. So $10 tomorrow won't necessarily buy what $10 buys today. Maybe it'll buy more, maybe it'll buy less. So we don't have the same issue when it comes to money. So why should we say this is only a problem if I'm lending you sugar? We should say it's a problem when it comes to money. So the answer is that for halachic purposes, as much as this may be at odds with what you read in the Wall Street Journal, but for halachic purposes, we define currency as that which does not change. Currency is the standard by which everything else is measured. So therefore, to whatever extent the dollar fluctuates, that's in a different world, but in halacha, the dollar is the standard, and everything else fluctuates in relation to the dollar in America. Now, in other countries, there'll be different currencies. So foreign currencies will be viewed as commodities in other countries. So in America, the dollar will be that which is constant, and in England, the pound will be that which is constant. Now, Israel gets a little bit more complicated because you could theoretically have an economy where more than one currency may be effective, and that gets to a complicated discussion. But for now, let's assume, just for simplicity's sake, that we have one currency, and that's what's going to be defined as that which is consistent. So there's not a prohibition of lending money when you're paying back the exact same amount of money. You're not going to have any issues with ribbis in that context. If I lent you $10 and you pay me back $10, whenever you pay it back, whatever fluctuations have taken place, that does not affect the currency. Currency is the standard by which everything else is measured. So therefore, it's the same $10 you pay me back. We don't pay attention to whatever has changed on the market in terms of what that $10 can buy. So it's important, and this is a topic Gemara brings up on Daf Mendalet Amud Beis as an application of what the Mishnah talks about, to define what we call tiva in the Gemara. It's a language for kesef, currency. That's the phrase the Gemara uses in our Gemara, tiva meaning currency, and pere meaning fruits. Carnivores among us may object to fruits being the symbol of commodities, but whatever it is, that pere is the way the Gemara talks about the commodity itself. So just to have the two things to reflect it off each other, tiva and peire. So tiva is the currency and peire is the commodity. So I have a problem lending commodities, but I won't have a problem lending kesef, lending tiva. So the Gemara does address in that context, for the purpose of Hilchos Ribbis, we have to define what is what. But before getting to that, the Mishnah addresses it in a different context, which really requires you to know some things later in the Gemara. So maybe it would have helped you to know this before Seder, but at least I'll tell you to now. I'll tell you now, so you'll be aware of some of this background. That the Gemara wants to know what is called commodity and what is called money, because we need to figure out when a transaction is final. That's the topic of this first Mishnah. And it draws on a major machlokas that appears within the Gemara itself. That, and in the Mishnah, we see that the definition of currency and commodity could change depending on what we're dealing with. That for this purpose, for the purposes of Mekach and Memkar, this is separate from the Ribbis context, that if two people are trading something, and we're dealing especially in an era where money was a little bit less well-defined than it is today. So the assumption is that if I'm giving you an item and you're giving me something in exchange for that item, so something represents the commodity and something represents the money. Something is going to be considered kesef and something tifa, and something is going to be considered peyre. So why does it matter which is which? Because only one of them affects the final sale. And our Mishnah assumes that it is only the commodity that affects the final sale. That the person who takes possession of the commodity, that represents the actual transaction in a irrevocable sense. Obviously, everything is revocable in money. You could just decide to do whatever you want. But we're talking about where there's not going to be an agreement between the two. So, assuming both parties don't agree, so the sale is final once the commodity has been taken possession. But the paying of the money for the commodity does not reflect the final sale. And if money has been paid, so then that doesn't mean the sale is done, and at least in the first opinion of the Mishnah, both parties have the right to undo the sale. So this draws upon a major machlokas of Yochanan and Rish Lakish, which appears in our parak. If you take a look, we'll look at it together on Mem Zayin and Mid Beis. As you see, the assumption of the Mishnah is that the only thing that makes the sale final is what we call Meshicha, is taking the possession of the item. So here the Gemara says, it's actually a machlokas, Rabbi Yochanan and Rish Lakish. So Am Rabbi Yochanan is the middle of Mem Zayin and Beis, the two dots. Am Rabbi Yochanan, Dvar Torah, Maos Konos. That according to Rabbi Yochanan's opinion, the Mishnah as it is doesn't really reflect the Din Min HaTorah. That according to the Din, that the Torah has it, Maos is actually what seals the deal. Paying the money for the transaction is actually what makes the sale irrevocable. So Mepnei Ma Amro Meshicha Kona. So then why do we say in practice that the way the Mishnah reflects that it's Meshicha that makes it final and it's not the most? So says the Gemara, Gezeira Shamayomalo Nisrafu Chitecha Baalia. Because we're worried about the following, that if, let's say, David is going to pay me money for this iPad, and I'm supposed to give him the iPad tomorrow, but the sale is final. So then I could come in tomorrow and say, oh, bad news, your iPad fried. There was a fire in Gluck where I left it, and the iPad is no longer, and it's your loss because it was yours. Right? So, no, what can you do? You already paid me for it, so I have the value, and you don't have the iPad. So the Gemara responds to that, well, what did I do? I burnt it on purpose so that I could keep your money and not give you anything. You know, so sof mandashad leka by shlume. If I set a fire, I'm going to have to pay for it. So really what we're concerned about is gezeira shema tipol leka ba'onas. Maybe I'll hear that there's a fire in Gluck where there is my iPad. So imok musle b'rishuse mosa nafshe tarachom natsil. Ilo lo mosa nafshe tarachom natsil. That we're worried that I'm not going to have any motive to make any effort to save it because it's your loss. Because I know you already paid me for it. So if anything happens to it, why should I exert myself to save your property? I'm going to get paid either way. But if I know that the sale's not final and that you could take your money back, so then I'll make an effort to make sure to actually get it and to get it back to you. So Rabbi Yochanan's position is And this seems to be the halacha lemaisa, and that itself is very significant, is that on a level minat Torah, that Mos is Kona, that really that would have created an irrevocable sale, but because of this concern that the person who has the commodity could pull some shtick or fail to work hard enough, so therefore the Chazal made a takana that that should not be the case, and Meshicha should be Kona. Now, we'll discuss that in a second, but just to see the other opinion of the Gemara, so Rish Lakish Amar Meshicha Mufarashis Minat Torah. So Rish Lakish says, no, that Meshicha as a Kenya Minat Torah is explicit in the Chumash. My time at the Rish Lakish, what's his source in the Chumash? The Pasuk in Parshas Behar, where it says, V'kisimkeru memkar lamisacha, okona miyada misacha, al tonu isha sachiv. So the source of the Yisr Ono, which the parak is eventually going to take up, is the major theme. So it also refers to a transaction, which is where the context of Ono is going to come up. So it uses the word, memkar lamisacha, okona miyada misacha. So says the pasuk, davar hanikne miyad liyad. That apparently this refers to something that is acquired from one hand to the other. It sounds like it's describing Meshicha. And Rabbi Yochanan doesn't have that interpretation because he says, Mos konos amiyad lumiyute karka delespe ona. That the reference to ona in the pasuk only applies to something hanikne miyad liyad, in other words, not karka. We'll get to what that means, the exclusion of karka from ona. It doesn't necessarily mean what it sounds like. We'll talk about that when we talk about hilchos ona. So essentially, this is a very important machlokas that has many implications. That basically what we see here is that there is a machlokas, what is kone min ha-Torah, that apparently this pasuk is referring to one thing or the other. Or specifically, Rish Lakish refers to a pasuk, that either it's Meshicha that's Kona min ha-Torah, or it is Mos that's Kona min ha-Torah. And our Mishnah sounds like it's Meshicha that's Kona, except that Rabbi Yochanan's opinion, which does seem to be the dominant opinion in Lahalacha, is that really Mos would have been Kona, Mona midin darais is Kona, but Chazal found it necessary to make a gezeira. But nonetheless, this is an important conceptual machlokas. What is it that's really kone min ha-Torah? And this also gets even more complicated because the Gemara in Maseches Bechoros and Daf Yud Gimel has a drush on the word amisecha in order to make the point that there are different kinyanim between Jews and non-Jews, where we have Jews with each other and Jews with non-Jews. So apparently the Gemara over there says that whichever kinyan it is that works min ha-Torah between two Jews, it's the opposite between a Jew and a non-Jew. So that already makes things very complicated. It leaves some complexity. We're not 100% sure which kinyanim work in order to transfer property between Jews and non-Jews. And this is one of the reasons why Mechiras Chametz is very complicated. So this is something that we spoke about at great length last year. It was probably a better topic to leave for this year because it draws on all of us Bav Masiya connections. I'm not sure why Pesach time we focused on so much last year. But in any event, so the question of how we do Mechiras Chametz on Erev Pesach, so we actually use 6, 7, 8 kinyanim, depending on how you do it. We try to use as many kinyanim as possible because there is an open question as to which kinyanim are effective. We're not sure which kinyanim are effective min ha-Torah, which kinyanim are effective min d'Rabbanan. And because we're afraid of an Issa d'Oraisa on Pesach of Baal Yirah, so we want to make sure to get a kinyan that's effective on a level min ha-Torah. And there's an added complexity that since the transaction by its very nature is happening with a non-Jew, so we want to make sure that we get the right kinyan that is effective in that context. So we try to do all the different kinyanim that we can possibly pull off in that setting in order to make sure that we're 100% guaranteed that this kinyan has actually gone through. So there is this machlokas in the Gemara as to what the kinyan really is min ha-Torah, and then whatever it is seems to be the opposite in terms of between a Yisrael and a Akum. There's also a whole discussion, the Rishonim debate. So if Rabbi Yochanan is right, that most konos min haTorah, so then what about kinyanim that shouldn't require most? Let's say you want to give somebody a gift. So what reflects the transaction then? So are you saying Mashiach is not a kinyan at all min haTorah according to Rabbi Yochanan? So you don't need it, you need something, right? What's gonna be the kinyan? So that was the big machlokus Rishonim. Do you say that there'll have to be something other than Mashiach? It'll have to be a kinyan chatzar, a kinyan daladama, something like that. Or should we say that no, Mashiach does work when there's no mos involved? It's only that when you have mos, so then Mashiach is relegated to a lower level. That perhaps the idea is that, which makes a lot of sense, that you need the kinyan takes place when you have a complete transaction. So if the transaction requires payment, so then it's only finished when you have this aspect of it. That requires that represents the complete transaction. And then it's a discussion. There's a nice discussion about this in the Sefer Chavetz Chaim and Parshas Bahar, that maybe what we're saying here is that we need to define what is a transaction. If the Torah says ki simkaru memkar, so what is that memkar? What means that? So whatever signifies that taking place, that's when the kinyan happens. And perhaps if the kinyan doesn't require any transfer of money, it's a gift or the like, or maybe there was already prepayment. Maybe somebody has an account that they already have paid more than they've received, so there's no need for money to be transferred. So then maybe we would define it differently. So that's the whole question, whether Mashiach is going to maintain its status, even if, or maintain its lack of status, even if there is no money involved. So that had this idea, that if we paskin like Rabbi Yochanan, that mina Torah mos konos, so that's also very significant, because what happens if you have something that was purchased only with Mos, without Mashiach? So does it really mean that the sale is absolutely nothing, especially if it was valid min haTorah? Are we trying to say that Chazal really completely negated it? Or does it mean that they only instituted this ability to change your mind, but the sale is valid, which has some very significant ramifications? Right, in our Mishnah, the Mishnah says that yes, you can go back if it's only money that's been given, but that's not something we do lightly. Right? The Mishnah says in the end that Yochel Achzer Bo Aval Amru Mishapara Manshe Dor Hamidbar Midor Haflaga. It's very scary. Who also the Para Mimisha Eino Omer B'Diburo. That whoever reverses his promises, whoever makes a deal and then goes back on it without the justification, is subject to a klala. It's a big deal. It's subject to this big criticism. So is that a way of saying that really the deal is good, just we made this back door, you can get out if necessary? Or are we saying that the sale really has completely been negated by Chazal? So the Meiri and others, assume Meiri quotes from the Ravid over here on this Mishnah, that really the sale does take place when Mos are given. And Rabbi Yochanan's Mos Konos Dvar Torah, that really is still in place. It's simply that theoretically the seller could back out, or either one could back out. But if it turns out they don't want to back out, so then retroactively the sale did happen from that point in time. So if somebody, for example, was Makdish, the item that he bought with Mos, so that Hekdish is valid. Right? That's a little bit evocative of our last sugi in the first parak that we did, the Takfu Kohen Gemara, right? The question of when somebody has enough control over an item to be makdish it. So the Meiri writes over here that if somebody bought something with Mos and then retroactively we see that the sale was not objected to, so then that sale was good from that point, and if he was makdish it or something along those lines, it should be effective. So one of the major issues which comes up, and this, by the way, could be extremely practical the way things are purchased today, this is not at all a theoretical question. What if somebody buys a wedding ring this way and does kedushin, and the only way the sale was effected was through Mos? You could easily imagine that happening. It's not a theoretical question at all. So is the kesef kedushin Is it his? And is the Kedushin valid? So it sounds like from this Meiri, this discussion that Pesukei Tshuva has, Nassim Gestetner has a number of Tshuvas about this in the Laharis Nassim, that it sounds like based on this Meiri that the Kedushin would be valid, that it's essentially his from that time. He raises a little bit of a suffix, Laharis Nassim, that maybe you might want to distinguish between Kedushin and other areas, because we know that we have a requirement that the woman perceive it as an absolute transaction. So that's why, for example, we have the Kveda, which is Likuva, that we don't put fancy stones on the ring because we don't want to create any ambiguity as to what the value is. We want the ring to be very simple. So it's crucial not only that this be his and it be given to her, but that she properly assess what's happening, that she understand it as given to her and understand within reason what it's worth. So therefore, he raises the suffix that since the deal could be reversed, so even if retroactively it's going to turn out to be his, maybe we should worry about the smichas das of the isha, that maybe we should worry that she's not...
she has no
health. How do you know? Maybe she should be going out with different girls. Who knows what she knows? Maybe she does know. So it's all possible. It sounds like from Rashi... Rashi over here, Ramim Chesim and Aleph, because the Shuvah notes this, that it would be Kedushin according to Rabbi Yochanan. Right? Rashi Kai B'Aval, this is about a quarter of the way down, at the top of Ramim Chesim and Aleph, right? Nafkamina Lini Yisur, Ekronim Kiddush, Bawasa Ish, Rabbi Yochanan, have the Kedushin, the Mudai Sakanya. And according to Rish Lakish, it wouldn't be. So what the status is, Allah Lamais, a little bit of a discussion. But that's a major difference in terms of what we're defining here. So we're a little bit over time, let you go in a second. But essentially, the point of our Mishnah is that because we have this rule that only Mashiach is Kone Lamaisa, whether that's a Din Daraisa or a Takanas Chachamim, so therefore we need to know regarding the two aspects of the transaction, what is the kesef and what is the peros? And you could ask, and here since we see it fluctuates, and that's what the topic of this first amud is, that it's going to depend, it's all relative. We have the two items, one is going to be one, one's going to be the other, it's going to be relative to which one has a greater claim to being the currency. So if that's the case, so why don't we let the two parties determine amongst themselves? Why do we have these standards that we look at the item and we define it that way? Why should it be based on that? So there's a discussion about this. We mentioned the Sefer Chametz Halacha Sashar. So he asserts that essentially the whole nature of that drasha on Mem Zayin is that it's based on the Pasuk. The Pasuk telling us there is a tzura of Mekach u'Memkar, and within that tzura you have currency and you have a commodity, and lahalacha, it's the commodity that defines the sale. So therefore, we need to have some type of a definition that's based on the tzura, not based on what the two parties are going to decide on their own, but that's based on what's actually happening, what's going to be defined as the pera, and what's going to be defined as the teva, as the tiva, and that's essentially what our Mishnah gets into, and we'll then go from there into topics, a little bit about ribbis, a little bit about the Maaser Sheni and the like, and eventually get us more into general transactional issues, which will bring up a topic of Ona, which the rest of the parak will deal with. Okay, I hope that's a somewhat helpful and belated introduction. And tomorrow, do you know anything about luck tomorrow?